everybody. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be back here. I think it was about 3 years ago was the last time I was up at this group. This group has grown. You know, you can really feel the enthusiasm in this group. Certainly the business structure and service functions are really healthy here. That's not always the case, but I'm really glad to be here. You know, one of the times I came up to this group, there was a visiting speaker in town. He had flown in from Minneapolis. And I remember coming up here, and I was supposed to speak, but we had this guy from Minneapolis who told a really great story, and we had him speak here. And he's now drinking. This guy was speaking all over the place, and now he's drinking. And you know, I think that's one of the reasons why we're here tonight, because I don't know about anybody else, but drinking really didn't work for me. It didn't stop me from doing it, but it did not work for me. I mean, you know, the last 8 years of my drinking was just a debacle. You know, sane people, normal people look at people like me and say, "Why? What are you doing?" The biggest question I ever got asked was, "What's wrong with you?" You know, anybody in here ever been asked, "What's wrong with you?" I mean, oh my God, how do you answer that? You know, that's a really, you know, I understand the question, but how do you answer that? It's just too big of an answer to even be able to get involved. What's wrong with me? You know, where do I start? I was until the very end, I was truly convinced that the alcohol was helping me deal with what was wrong with me. I really thought the alcohol was the short vacations I needed from like the being the burden of being Chris. You know what I mean? From a very young age, I had anxiety, and I had a lot of self-centered fear. You know, I just was uncomfortable with myself, and I was uncomfortable with my environment. And I can remember back in school, where, you know, if I had to give like an oral report in front of the class, I'd freak out. You know, I'd cut school for like 3 days just to make sure that, you know, I didn't have to do it. Now, one of the worst things, this memory haunted me because it just made me so uncomfortable. Does anybody in here remember square dancing from school? Like in sixth or seventh grade? Oh my God! In our school, what they would do is there'd be a gigantic gymnasium, and all the women would be there, all the girls would be there, and all the men would be there, and they'd line up the guys on one side of the gym, and the girls on the other side, and they'd blow the whistle, and you'd have to, like, run across the gym and, like, ask a girl to dance. It was like, are you kidding me? You know what you're doing to, like, not, you know, like, pre-alcoholic people? Like, you know, they're, like, still in therapy, about this. And, you know, I shared this story in a meeting one time, and a woman came up to me and goes, how do you think we felt, you know? Like, I can imagine. Now, listen, you give me a pint of vodka, and I'm the fastest sprinter in one of those things. You know, I'll go for the best-looking woman. But you know, like no, with no alcohol to have to deal with something like that, what was their problem, you know? Square dancing. So you know, for many years I did without alcohol, which was very difficult for me, you know? I mean, with all this like self-centered fear, just feeling not right. Unbelievably attached to my impression of what you thought of me. I mean, the worst possible thing that could happen was for me to be embarrassed by looking stupid, you know? I was so attached to, like, always being cool. And listen, stuff happens and you look like an idiot, you know? And those periods of time were absolutely traumatic. Well, one day, a couple of my buddies decide we're going to cut school and we're going to go back to my house and we're going to get drunk. And this sounded like a really cool thing to do when you're like 11 or 12. So that's what we did. We cut school. We went back to my house. Now, I'd never had alcohol before. I didn't really know much about it. I remember the John Wayne movies where he'd bust through the saloon doors and he'd go, "Bartender, whiskey!" And the bartender would pour a big glass of whiskey, and he'd drink it down, he'd grab the bottle, and he'd go back to his table, and he'd shoot somebody. You know what I mean? That's all I can remember. I mean, you know, there wasn't a lot of drinking. I had to dust off this Four Roses bottle. Yeah. So here we are, it's about 8 in the morning, and I pour out 3 big water glasses of this Four Roses whiskey. Now, I know now that, you know, Four Roses whiskey warm in a big glass isn't really the way you do it, you know? I mean, I didn't let it breathe, I didn't mix it with anything, I just Canadian whiskey straight. So we started drinking, and the interesting thing is what happened to the two guys that I was drinking with. Because they never became alcoholic. As far as I know, they never became problem drinkers. They were just kids that wanted to cut school with me. They drank about 2/3 of their glass, and they'd had enough. You ever drink with people that have enough on you? You know, that's awful, isn't it? What do you mean you've had enough? It's only 11 o'clock. Let's go to the city. You know, let's go. You mean you got to go to work? I mean, I hated that. I hated drinking with people who didn't know how to get the job done, you know? And I got the job done. Anyway, these guys had enough, and they sat back and they watched the show. Because I drank all of my glass, the rest of their glass, the rest of the bottle, and I went into my first blackout at like age 11 or 12. Any blackout drinkers in here? Oh, man, that can be disconcerting. Can it? You know, you wake up in some strange town with one shoe. And you don't want to look stupid. You know, you don't want to, like, ask why you're there. You got to pretend you wanted to be in Topeka, you know. I always go to Topeka, you know. Trying to find my other shoe. So I went into a black, and I don't remember much, but I came to in a field, you know. And I'm like, what am I doing here? And I go back to that, and I trash the house. I busted windows, and, you know, and then, you know, and I started to get sick. The first time you drink like that, you know, it's not even a hangover. It's like deathly illness, you know. And I remember just like for 2 days I was horizontal. I was just as sick as a dog. Oh my God, I wanted to die. And now really think about this. If it would have been anything except alcohol, I probably never would have touched it again. If it was a non-alcoholic that got sick, and I've known some of them that drank too much and got sick and never touched it again, you know? I mean, but the thing was that alcohol did something for me. And I remember, you know, before I went into a blackout and became a vomiting pig, I remember what it did for me. You know, that repressed, like that anxiety, that just feeling just not right, not connected to anything, not, you know, always worrying about something. That was gone. As soon as I started to experience, like, my second glass of this Four Roses, all of a sudden I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. You know what I mean? I couldn't care less what you would think, what you thought about me. You're lucky to be with me. You know what I mean? You know, maybe I'll keep in touch, you know? And I was the funniest, you know? And I had the fear was gone, the anxiety was gone. And I was larger than life, you know? And then I went into the blackout. But what happened was, yes, I was sick. I was sick as a dog for 2 days. But what alcohol did for me, I couldn't forget that. That was like finding the Chris antidote, you know, that I've been looking for forever. I finally thought that I found a tool that would enable me to feel like you guys feel. Because you guys couldn't possibly have the same issues that I've got, you know. So I started drinking, I didn't become a daily drinker, but I started to become very preoccupied with alcohol. Where was I going to get it? You know, I was 12, and the drinking age was 21. You know, it was problematic, but not insurmountable. You know what I mean? Where was I going to drink it? You know, what was it going to be? Who can I get to, you know, who can I get to drink? And I started to find the people who knew how to drink. And, you know, it was on the weekends and stuff. And almost immediately, I was getting in trouble. But, you know, crashing a car here, getting a DUI there. That was a small price to pay for what alcohol did for me. Because I could step out, you know what I mean, with this stuff. I could go to the parties and I could talk to the people that I wanted to talk to. And I could come off like, you know, like nothing was bothering me. Now, if I wasn't drunk, I'd be like in the corner, you know, like real quiet. I can maybe talk to one or two people, but I'm not going to tell stories in front of, you know, 10 people unless I got some alcohol. So I started to become real preoccupied, and I started to drink. Now, again, almost immediately, I would get in trouble. I remember at 17, I remember my first DUI. I went to a bar, the Pittstown Inn in New Jersey. It's like way out in the country, and they had barn dancing there. but it's different when you're drinking, okay? There was like a country band there, and Andrea, my wife, actually went there with me, believe it or not. And she remembers probably more of this than I do. Anyway, I allowed myself to become overserved. You know how that is. And I remember chugging pitchers of beer. Okay, that, you know, in the 21 question pamphlet, they should have that. You know, do you chug pitchers of beer? You know, you may be alcoholic. I remember like chugging, you know, beers all over me and everything. It's the middle of winter, and the person who was going to be my designated driver, like, just abandoned me, or I lost them, or I left without them, I don't know. But I ended up driving on the way home, and about 2 miles from the bar, I'm going down this hill, and there's some black ice, and I hit it. The car spins around backwards and hits a bridge abutment going backwards. All of a sudden, I come to, and I'm outside the back window. My legs are still in the car, but I'm on the trunk, like, looking up at the sky. And thinking, whoa, this isn't good. And, you know, but what do you do? What do you do when something like that happens in your drinking? What's your, you got a homing instinct. You know, I'm going home. So I get back in the car. The car's got three flats. It's bent like a boomerang. There's not a window left in it. The drive shaft is slapping the frame, and I start driving home. I remember going by a cop. Okay, the car's going like this, wagging a boogie to the van, wagging a boogie to the van. This cop is giving radar. You know, what? And he didn't even pull me over. He walks me over. Okay, because I'm going 2 miles an hour. I remember he reaches through the broken window and starts shaking me. Where did you have that accident? I'm like, what accident, officer? Glass is coming out of my hair. Get out of the car. You know how they are, you know. And he's going, where are you going? And I go, I'm going home. Well, where is that? I go, Masterkey Ridge. He goes, that's 28 miles. You don't have any tires. You cops are always hassling me. You know how they are. Let me fast forward to my last DUI, okay? Like 20 years later. You know, once more I'm at a party, and they overserved me. And I'm on my way home from this party, and supposedly I crossed the double yellow. You know how cops are. You know what I mean? And the lights go on, I pull over, he knocks on the window, you know, what do you want, officer? And he's like, you crossed the double yellow. Yeah, I didn't. And he goes, license, registration, insurance card. So I get my license out and I hand it to him. Remember hazy recollections? They talk about that in the big book. That's like bits and pieces you can remember, but there's vague spots. You know, it's like almost blackout. Well, that's about where I was. But I do remember this. I'm grabbing for the registration and the insurance card, and it's my mother's car because I crashed mine. And I'm reaching and I'm looking, and it's her glove compartment. And it's got, you know, like all kinds of stuff in the glove. There's maps and tissues and, you know, games that you play on long trips and pens and, you know, all this crap. And I can't find it. And for about 5 minutes, I'm looking. So finally, I just give up and I grab the entire contents of the glove compartment and I hand it to the cop. And he's like, "Get out of the car." You know how they are. And, now, I don't remember much of the field sobriety. I don't. Next thing I know, I'm sitting in the police station with the bright lights. And I do remember, though, they videoed me. And I remember that. And I remember they gave me some sobriety tests. And I remember I nailed the ABCs. Okay. I nailed them. Say the ABCs. I nailed them. So I'm home. I come to the next day with the summons in my back pocket. You know, I'm indignant that I was pulled over, you know, and double yellow indeed, you know, and I had refused the breathalyzer. So I hire a lawyer. I hire this attorney. And this guy's like $1,500 because it's like one of my multiple, you know, they charge more every time you get one. You know, so the first thing we have to do is go to the police station and view the video, take a look at the evidence. Now this guy's in a three-piece suit, you know, he's got his leather notebook and everything, man, he's professional. And we go there and he asked the police to let us sit in a room and view the video. And I knew we were kind of in a little bit of trouble when they handed the tape to this guy. It was a VHS tape. The cop was doing this. I'm like, oh, no. Sure enough, he puts it in. He presses play. And I'm like, oh, my God. I was hammered. I was hammered. Have you ever seen yourself hammered on video? Don't ever do that. Just plead guilty. No, don't do that. I was horrified. It got to the ABCs that I nailed. Here's how I nailed them. A. B. Can I have a cigarette? C. I'm like, oh, no. There's pictures of me, like, when I'm walking the straight line, hanging on to the cops. I was terrible. It's like worse than any YouTube video you ever seen. And this whole time, this $1,500 lawyer is like, you know, he's taking notes. And it gets to the end. And on the video, the cop goes, Mr. Schroeder, we're about to turn off the video, and we'd just like to know if you'd like to add anything. I'm worried now, you know, because I don't remember this part. Sure enough, I look at the camera, and I go, now the lawyer loses it. He's been composed up until now. Now he's going, oh, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen anybody do. Chance at all, you just. I'm like, oh, God, I guess we're gonna plead. Oh. You know, I mean, these kind of things were happening to me all the time. I mean, you know, I would come to in jail, not knowing why I was there. I mean, be in the bunk, you know, like, I'm in jail. Oh my God. Last thing I remember, I was at a party, you know. I learned something very important. Don't wake your bunkmate up and ask him what's going on. Because sometimes they're unconcerned. You know, very selfish people you bump into in prison. And another thing, don't say keep in touch with the people that you meet there because they will. That's a whole other story. Oh, my God. So these kind of things were just constantly happening to me. I mean, problem after problem after problem. Never once during those days did I say to myself, I've got to stop drinking. I would say, I got to stop driving. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, because alcohol, even though alcohol was causing these debacles, I still saw alcohol as a solution. And it really is. Alcohol is the treatment for alcoholism. It is. It's a bad treatment, though. over the course of time, it becomes a big enemy, you know? Like, the treatment, the real problem, here's my real problem. Let's look at the last couple of years of my drinking. I would come to in the morning wearing the clothes that I was in the night before. I would just be reeking of booze. I'd go into the bathroom, I'd do my vomiting calisthenics. You know, I did that. That was my exercise every morning. And, I'd go off to work. On the way back home from work, it would be like to the liquor store. I mean, you know, autopilot, like, I got to get to the liquor store. You know, I mean, the last couple of hours of my work, you know, I'm just thinking about getting to the liquor store to get some booze. And if you were doing like 30 and a 40 in front of me, I'd pass you on a blind turn and cut you off and give you a finger. You know, I got to get to the liquor store. I'd go in the liquor store. I knew right where my Gordon's vodka or my George Dickel bourbon was. I made sure they never ran out, you know. And I'd head for it, and then I'd head up to pay for it, and there'd be somebody in line asking, what kind of wine goes with tilapia? Are you crazy? Get rid of that lady. I got a minus. Get out of my way. I got a problem. I'm sober. I need to get out of here and start drinking. What don't you understand? Now think about this. What really is my problem? My problem is being sober. I can't stand it. I got to have that booze. As soon as I buy it and I get out to the car and I got it in my hand, it's like, you know? And when I get home and I pour a big, I had these 24-ounce glasses, you know, because I wanted to be able to say I just had two. You know, and I put like 20 ounces of bourbon and, you know, four of Coke. And I drink a couple of those. Try ordering one of those at the bar. You know? I remember this one time I went up to the bartender and I said, triple bourbon and Coke. He's like, looks at me really strange. So he goes ahead and he does it. And there's like only that much room left for the Coke. And he's got the spritzer and he looks at me. And I go, and he goes, Listen, bartenders understand. This guy's going to be a problem. Triple bourbon. Okay? You know, we're going to be flagging him or, you know, escorting him out. But anyway, what's my real problem? I'm like free until I can get some booze in me. The real problem, so many people out there in the world think alcohol is our problem. It's a bigger problem than that. Alcoholism is our problem. Alcoholism is the guy behind the lady asking about wine and tilapia. That's alcoholism. Get out of my way. You know, the booze for a moment treats that internal condition, and then I become a vomiting pig later because, you know, I have a compulsion that, you know, one drink asks for the second insists on the third demands the fourth. The fourth insists on the fifth, and I drink myself into unconsciousness. That was basically my pattern. But the thing is that internal spiritual condition is my problem. I'm restless, irritable, and discontented on a good day, sober. On a normal day, sober, I'm filled with anxiety, depression, self-centered fear, guilt, shame, remorse, all of these feelings. Emotionally, I'm crippled because of the spiritual malady of alcoholism. Sober. And then on a bad day, it's the hideous four horsemen galloping through. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You ever been there? Like after a spree or something? The alcoholic is 60 times more likely to take their own life than the non-alcoholic. We kill ourselves in batches because of that spiritual malady, because of that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And normally we do it sober. We don't do it drunk. So that's my real problem. I haven't a clue, though. I'm thinking alcohol is my solution. It's the only thing that works. It's the only thing that makes me relax. It's the only thing that gets me out of my head enough so that I can just shut off the voices, shut off the thinking, and just relax. Now, the problem, though, is alcoholism is normally progressive. So if you're an alcoholic over any considerable period of time, it always gets worse. It never gets better. Whether you're drinking or not, alcoholism gets worse. Don't believe somebody that says it gets better. Lying bastards, okay? Alcoholism gets worse. If you don't treat it with spiritual living, your anxiety is going to get worse, your depression is going to get worse, you're going to go get medicated like a crazy person, you're going to end up picking up a drink, you're going to go insane, or you're going to kill yourself. That's what happens to alcoholics who don't find some type of form of treatment. Now, here I am. I signed myself into a 28-day program. This is early 1989. And, you know, what had happened was there was just a series of, you know, bad breaks, misunderstandings, debacles, you know, car crashes, you know, families leaving, you know, all this nightmare. But what happened was I was slowly starting to lose my mind. When I was going into these blackouts, I was getting increasingly violent. And I was doing some things that when I came to and found out what I had done or what I tried to do, it was horrifying me. And I really thought that I was losing my mind. Because, you know the book, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? I believe Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. And I believe that that book had a lot to do with the alcoholic blackout drinker. Because, you know, you can be Dr. Jekyll and you can be kind of cool. And then you can be Mr. Hyde where you're an absolute animal. And that's what was happening to me. So I needed to do something about this. I did not want to end up in prison. I did not want to hurt somebody in my family or kill somebody in my family. And you know, it was getting to the point where something like that really could happen. So I signed myself into this 28-day treatment center. I didn't know anything about alcohol. My whole point was to separate from alcohol. That's what I thought I needed to do. That's obvious, right? Separate from alcohol. So I go to this 28-day treatment program, and that was very interesting. Listen, folks, there are some crap rehabs out there, okay? I am not one of these people that believe that if you're in the rehab, you're in the right place. There are some just crap rehabs where all it is it's a revolving door with a cash register. And I ended up in one of those places in Morristown, New Jersey. I remember I had one one-on-one counseling session in 28 days for $13,000. You know what they did to us? They put us in group. Anybody ever been in group? Where you sit around in a big circle and it's a free-for-all. Tell us how you feel. Oh, my God. They will, too. They'll tell you how you feel. Oh, there was this one guy, Doug, who just, he would hog the whole group session. You know? He had really, he'd sit there and he, you know, my wife, I got restraining orders, I lost my job, I'm going to do, you know, let's just tell I can't tell, I'm going to jump in front of a bus. You know, he's always threatening to jump in front of a bus while he hogs 45 minutes of the hour. I want to share. You know what I mean? I remember going downstairs to the nurse. Now, you couldn't use phones or anything. And I used to go, listen, I really need the phone. And she's like, what do you need the phone for? I go, I got to order some bus schedules. You know? In treatment, I was no vision for you, I will tell you. I'd just be sitting there like looking at somebody's channel. Why don't you drink? Why don't you drink and just shut up and get the hell out of here? God, I don't want to hear your crap anymore. I want to share. And that stuff translated right over to when I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to every closed-minded discussion meeting you could possibly go to. You know what I mean? Because I thought that, you know, treating alcoholism, you know how you treat alcoholism? You share. That's what I thought. So I'm going to all these meetings and I'm sharing. And I got to tell you, I am burning with resentment. I'm burning with self-centered fear. I've got remorse for, you know, I am an untreated alcoholic. I am so dry, you know, I'm flammable. And I'm sitting in these meetings, and I hated every, maybe there'd be two people in a meeting I'd hate. And I'd just be sitting there, and, you know, somebody would finish sharing, and all of a sudden I'd go, no, he's raised his hand, not him, oh, that hypocritical bastard, oh, don't call him, they call him, oh my God, now we gotta hear about his family. Oh, tell somebody who cares. He's going to tell us how grateful he is. I'm going to slash all four of his tires in the parking lot, and I want to see gratitude in action, you know? Oh. But you, this is what's going on in my head. But you'd come up to me and you go, Chris, how you doing? Great. I'm sober today, so I'm a winner, you know? Oh, my God. I was going out of my mind. And listen, this is not unusual for alcoholics. Heavy drinkers can go in and cheer their way happy. If you're an alcoholic, it ain't going to work. You're trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? So you're not, you know, I'm trying everything because I'm going nuts inside every day. You know, I don't have my alcohol to check out anymore. So life is stark raving in front of me. And, you know, I'm hanging on. I'm not drinking one day at a time. And this guy comes up to me, Radio Shack Mike. And you know, he's one of these guys that goes to the New Age bookstore. You know, and he'll bring a pyramid home, you know. Or he'll tell you, he'll be doing the Kabbalah this week and, you know, the Course in Miracles. He was just whacked. And he hands me these 8 90-minute tapes. He goes, you're hardcore. I couldn't take these. He goes, you're hardcore. Here, you'll like this. And it was a big book workshop that was done sometime in the 80s by a couple of guys named Joe and Charlie. I think probably most of us have heard about Joe and Charlie if you haven't heard the workshop. Now, here I am. I am so alcoholic. Like, if there's a scale of alcoholism, you know, I'm up here, and most of the people in the meetings are here because they're sharing, and everything's fine. I'm like nuts. And I start to listen to these tapes, and immediately I get a resentment from people from Arkansas, because that's where they're from, you know. What the hell does somebody from Arkansas know? I really saw that these guys were way off track. This is not how we do it in New Jersey. We share. And we go to speaker meetings, and we make coffee, and we do all this other stuff. That's how we treat our alcoholism. What are they talking about? But I listened to the whole set of tapes. I had a long ride to work, and I told the guy I would. The information in those tapes haunted me. What they said to me that I was so upset about was this. Chris, if you're not working a program of recovery out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have an AA program. You could, your fellowship, and you might be the pope of the fellowship, but you have no program of recovery unless you're working the steps out of the book, out of the big book. Now, again, this upset me. No, you know, there really wasn't any big book. There was one big book meeting four towns away, and I used to go to it, and they would read the entire big book, all the way through all the stories, you know, so you'd be on the stories three quarters of the time because there's just so many stories. That didn't click. You know, people would read and then just share whatever they wanted to share. I didn't get anything from that particular meeting. But there were 12 and 12 meetings. Let me tell you, there were 12 and 12 meetings. Galore. I was going to 12 and 12 meetings because, you know, it's up on the wall. The 12 steps, you need to be paying attention to them. I didn't know how to apply them, though, until I listened to this Joe and Charlie workshop. I would go to these step meetings, and I would share about the steps. I'd listen to the steps being read, and I'd philosophize about the steps. And I'd identify with the steps, and really, Will was great, you know. But I wasn't doing them. You know, the problem with the steps is you actually have to do them. That's a great word to put in front of every step. Actually made direct amend. You know, actually, you know, did an inventory. Because if you go to enough 12 and 12 meetings, you think that if you agree with the steps in theory, everything's good. I agree with that in theory. I mean, mean, you'd be in a ninth step meeting and somebody would raise their hand and say, I haven't done this step formally. But I'm going to take the meeting hostage for the next 10 minutes and share my opinion on what I think it might be like if I ever bothered to do it. You know, that's what was happening at the step meetings. So all of a sudden, you know, these Joe and Charlie tapes, they come from left field. They're talking about actually doing this stuff. You know, I put them to my sponsors not showing me this. Nobody's sharing about this stuff. I'll put them over here. Now, alcoholism is progressive. The spiritual malady is progressive unless it's treated with spiritual living. So what's happening is every single day I'm getting worse. I'm going to 12 meetings a week. I'm the secretary over here. I'm the GSR over there. I'm driving the boobies from the hacks to the meetings. I'm going out to the diners. I'm making so much coffee the grinds are coming out of my ears. But I'm still absolutely insane. And some things happened in my life. And I got to a point where I was about that. I started to understand what a nervous breakdown might be. You know what I mean? Like, a couple of things happened. You know, a breakup, a car crash, a lost job, problems with motor vehicles. All this stuff hit me all at once. And I didn't have the tools for the capacity. And I remember thinking, there's only a couple of things I can do. I can drink. I can kill myself and just get this over with. And then the thought crossed my mind that, you know, those tapes, the message in those tapes haunted me. So what I did was talk to my sponsor, kind of got myself grouped together a little bit. Went up into my room, put the tape recorder on, opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, put a pad out, and I started going through these Joe and Charlie tapes and going through the big book. And where there was an instruction, stop, turn it off. Don't read the big book like it's the Da Vinci Code. It's a textbook. You know, do the problem. You know, a lot of times, some of the guys I sponsor are like this. Let's say that you wanted to get the calculus experience, okay? You really wanted, you needed the tools of calculus to get along with your life. But you just started going to the calculus class, and you'd share about calculus, and you'd listen to people talk about calculus, and you'd say, I'm grateful for calculus. But you never opened up the book. You never learned how to solve the problems. You never did the exercises. You know, what kind? Wouldn't you be crazy? You know, that would be like the person who's going to the hospital because they've got cancer and they need the treatment for cancer, but all they do is sit in the waiting room and talk with other people who've got cancer and identify and don't compare with the other people who have cancer, but they never get the operation. They just sit in the waiting room talking about it. I mean, wouldn't that be crazy? It would be, but I see it happening all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming into 12-step fellowships and not, you know, the 12 steps are the treatment for alcoholism, you know. Going to meetings is not a treatment for alcoholism. Going to meetings will create a sober environment that will be tenuous until you find that there's actually some type of recovery, until you change. If you stay that same person just sober going to meetings and you really are alcoholic, you're going to go crazy, you're going to get locked up, you're going to kill yourself, or you're going to drink. If you're able to hang on and stay sober, you're going to be awful cranky. You ever meet those cranky old-timers? You know, never a good word to say about anybody? They're the first people to raise their hand and say something like, you know, when I came into AA, if they told me I have to do all these steps and I have to take all this and I have to do all this, I'd have been right out the door. And my first thought is, you're overestimating how much we would have cared, whether we're here or not, you know? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know, how many newcomers have you killed with that crap, you know? But I don't judge. Patience and tolerance is my code. So anyway, I go through this book, you know, and I didn't do it out of any sense of virtue to like be a better AA or anything. I did it to stop feeling bad. I wanted to not feel bad anymore. I didn't want to be an emotional cripple anymore, just trying to pretend everything's okay. So I went through this, and what happened, you learn so much in hindsight, looking back on it. What I did was I was starting to treat my alcoholism. You look at the bedevilments on page 52, not being in control of your emotional nature, being prey to misery and depression, et cetera, et cetera. That really is the alcoholism. A symptom of that alcoholism is the alcohol and drinking. what I started to do is I started to treat the emotional and spiritual condition with the steps. That's what it's for. The brilliant thing about Dr. Bob and Bill, you know, I can't believe they got it so right. I mean, when you study some of our history, Bill Wilson was like this shyster. He was running around Wall Street trying to talk you out of money, you know, like an NA guy. You know what I mean? And Dr. Bob was a proctologist who's always detoxing with big hands. You know, he's like, oh, oh, oh. You know, you're like getting your proctor worked on. He's like, oh, with his big hands, you're like getting a second opinion, you know. I mean, when you think about where we come from, it's absolutely amazing how they got this so right. How they understood that you don't battle the alcohol. You don't battle it head on. You don't just not drink. You've got to do so much more than that. You have to heal your spirit. And that's what was happening to me when I was doing this stuff from the Joe and Charlie tapes. Now, I've got some guys that I'm sponsoring by this time because you go to 12 meetings a week and you share. It gets to the point where you can give some good share. You can. You know just what to share. You know, just, you know, be a little bit self-deprecating and make a little bit of fun of yourself about how stupid you were today, you know, and all that. And you don't want to upset anybody or annoy anybody and, you know, make everybody like you. I mean, I was doing that because, you know, I need to have you like me. So I had some people that I was sponsoring. They asked me to help them. And, you know, I said, sure, yes. You know, what do you want me to do? And, you know, so I've got all these guys, and it's really funny, but a lot of the crazy ones were coming and asking. I don't know why that was. You know, the real deranged ones. And most of them were drinking on me. I'm like, you ever have anybody drink on you, you know, when you're sponsoring them? It makes you look bad. You lose status, you know? So, you know, somebody come up to me, is Harry yours? You know, he's hitting on the new women, and he's borrowing money, you know, and causing trouble. Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him, you know. Now, I had just gone through the steps in a very, very, you know, it was not a thorough and fearless. I mean, I had done the best I could with a set of tapes and a book and a notebook because, you know, nobody was taking you through the steps in our area back then. You know, I did the best I could. So I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start bringing these guys over to my house, and we're going to start on the title page of the big book, and we're just going to read every word, and we're going to do kind of what I did. When there's an instruction, I'm going to get these guys to do it. So a whole series of guys that I sponsored came over, and we started that process. And I, you know, not knowing really what the hell I was doing at the time, I said, look, I can't ask somebody to do something I'm not willing to do. So I would redo the steps right along with them, you know, so that we're kind of doing it as partners. And here's the interesting thing that I found out, and this is true to this day. Every single person that came over to my house and went through the book and did the steps, actually, you know, did the inventory, actually shared things without holding it back, actually did an 8-step list, and actually paid the money back and made direct amends to the institutions and people that they had harmed. Every single one of those guys is still sober. We're talking from the early 90s now. There's some of the best friends I have in my life. They're still card-carrying AA members in good standing. working with people, with home groups, still plugged in very, very strong. Maybe not going to a meeting every night anymore, but certainly Alcoholics Anonymous and the spiritual, the 12-step spiritual life is still a very, very valid part of their life. I don't see them letting go of that. Now, what happened with the people who would come over to my house and we'd hit the 4-step or something, and they'd see it as an overreaction, you know, to a problem that they really, you know, kind of have under control, but they're not admitting it. You know, they would go away, and they would drop off, drop out of sight, or they'd change their meeting, or they'd change their sponsor. Now, most of those are gone. I don't see any of those guys at the meetings anymore. You know, the people who bought. And so do the steps still around decades later? Not do the steps. Who the hell knows where they are? That's what's observable to me. That's what's observable to me. I explain it like this. If you don't put enough into Alcoholics Anonymous, into the spiritual life, into the steps, into the service structures, if you don't put enough in, you're not going to get enough back to be able to stay. It's just, you're going to change your mind about how important this whole thing is. However, if you lock into this stuff and you participate, if your feet are always about the actions of service and recovery, you're going to get so much out of this, you're not going to want to go anywhere. It's a simple formula. You know, some of the things that are going on in my life today are pretty remarkable. When I got sober, I came to, you know, in AA in the late 80s as a bad electrician. I mean, that's what I was doing. I was a bad electrician. If I wired your house, you know, the joke would be, tell the people to sleep by the door. You know what I mean? I mean, I was doing, I did this one thing one time where, you know, there was two panels in the basement and one of them was full, so I'm just going to use this other panel. And I'm going to wire this kitchen addition. And what I didn't realize was it was a panel for the hot water heater. Back in the day, they used to have timer meters so that the hot water heaters would warm up when the electricity rates were low. So that's what I wired the whole kitchen addition to. The people call up my boss and say, great job on the kitchen, but it comes on at 8 o'clock at night and goes off at 6 in the morning. We eat at 5. This is unacceptable. You know, I mean, you know, one time I'm drilling down from the attic trying to get a wire into the wall, and you know, I had a auger bit about this long and then an extension, and you know, I back it out and I pull it out and it's like there's like cloth, a little bit of cloth on the end. Like, what? So I go downstairs and you know, I tell the guy, listen, I gotta look in your bedroom. He's like, why? I'm like, let's just go look. Open up his double doors, and there's like 30 suits all covered with plaster, and one of them's curled up into a holy hill. You know, I was constantly doing crazy stuff like this. Oh God! Back and you know, I was drinking, and listen, it was a great place to be an alcoholic in the trades, because you know, if you can get your work done, they don't care if your eyes are yellow, you know. And this one time I'm drinking, and most of my partners would really think I was lame. You know, they'd team up two electricians to go out to work. And this one time I'm putting a meter on the side of the house, and my partner's doing, he's in the truck and he's getting stuff ready for the panel inside. I'd been overserved the night before, as was my wont. And, you know how you have to rehydrate in the morning and you're just like, and, so this morning I bought a gallon of grape drink and I drank it down to rehydrate, and I'm sitting there working on the meter, and all of a sudden it's like, and I go, oh my God, I know I have 7.5 seconds, you know, to get somewhere. And I don't want my buddy to think I'm lame, you know, sitting there vomiting. So I know I'll run around the back of the house. So I tear around the back, and I just make it around the back of the house, and whoa! I mean, it's like a fire hydrant. I stucco the back of this house with purple vomit. Like this, right? And I figure in the backyard you'd be by yourself, right? But no, there's an adjoining deck from the property behind, and there's a mother, a father, and three kids having iced tea going. Mommy, mommy, the purple fuchsia from hell, mommy! Oh. You know, listen. Now, listen, I had a bad resume. You know what I mean? I could not give any references out. You know what I mean? I'd have to find dead phone numbers and make up names. Because you know, I went from one terrible job to another. And you know, I'm always getting called out. This one time, in a blackout, I called my boss. In a blackout, I had a resentment. He said something. You know how that is. What'd you say? You know? And so I call him up in a blackout, and I threaten his life. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to come in tomorrow. I'm going to kill you. But it was a blackout, right? So I don't remember doing it. So I go walking into work the next day. It's like, yo, what are you doing here? I'm like, what? What's your problem, man? You told me you were going to kill me. What'd you do? You know, we can't take, a terrible, terrible resume. Now, once you get sober, not just sobriety, but there's sobriety and there's recovery. I see sobriety as mere abstinence from alcohol. You want to get sober, punch a cop. Okay? And you can be sober for 30 days, 90 days. You'll be as sober as you need to be. But recovery is a fundamental change. It's a spiritual, fundamental, transformational change in the way you think, in the way you act, in your levels of compassion for the universe. You know, your anxiety levels drop off, your depression levels drop off, and you basically start to, you know, have a decent human experience in recovery. That's been my experience and my experience working with others. Now, as that started to happen over the years, I just started to become a little bit more dependable. You know, I started to not lie as much. Man, I used to just lie just because I had to lie. Like, where were you last night? L.A. You know, I mean, I just lie. So what's happened is I've become much more employable. I've become a better family member. I've become a better friend. And I'm not shooting myself in the foot every single day like I did back when I was drinking. And, you know, you start to live a spiritual life, you start to get spiritual promises. You start to live an ethical life, you know, certain things start to happen in your life. It becomes more dependable and less filled with turbulence and resistance. And that's really what's happened to me in my life today. I can't tell you how grateful I am for every minute on the planet these days. My biggest problem today is there's not enough hours in the day to do the stuff that I want to do. You know, back when I was drinking, I could just barely deal with, you know, waking up and going to work and getting home and drinking, you know, and if I had to fill out paperwork for an insurance company or something, it'd be like, I gotta fill this paperwork out! You know, I don't do paperwork! And I just had no dealage at all. You know, today I can't tell you the amount of responsibility that's on me from work. You know, I've got a million AA activities that I do, way too many. But I love every one of them. And you know, I am absolutely overpaid today in absolutely every way, and even financially. You know, which is, I used to say I'm overpaid every single way except financially. But you know, that started to happen. So I can't tell you how grateful I am to be here to have an opportunity to talk to a great group like this, and thank you very much.